Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Of the many mysteries frozen in ice and time in the Arctic, one of the most tantalizing is this. What exactly happened to Sir John Franklin's two well-stocked ships, and why did it take so long for the wreckage to be found? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The crew departed England in 1845, bound for the icy seas of the legendary Northwest Passage. Of 129 men aboard, not a single one returned alive. Over nearly three centuries, numerous search parties were sent to hunt for clues. But the wrecks of the HMS Terror and Erebus have only been discovered in the past couple of years, in part because generations of Inuits who knew the expedition's fate or something about it were largely ignored until recently. Journalist Paul Watson worked as a war reporter for 20 years. He was also Asia bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, and he covered the Arctic for the Toronto Star. His new book is called Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Sir John Franklin had a great deal of experience on the sea. He'd been to the Arctic, but by 1845, he was in pretty rough shape.
Yes, he was in the weeks before the expedition departed in 1845, he was age 59. And when he was lobbying for it, his age came up as an issue. They said, look, aren't you a little old for this? And aren't you also susceptible to the cold, which he took just as badly as the crack about his age? They said, you know, you're actually 60. And he said, no, not quite. I'll be 60 in a few weeks. But age clearly was an issue.
And 60 in 1845 is not the same as 60 in 2017.
That's for sure. Mm-hmm. But he was a tough guy. You know, Sir John Franklin gets a rough ride in parts of the long history of writing about him. In certain periods, he's treated as a bit of a bumbling fool. And the more that I read about him, and the more you read about his history, both as a war veteran, he was wounded, for instance, in the British attack on the city of New Orleans in the War of 1812. Not seriously, but wounded in the shoulder by a sniper. He was deaf in one ear because of a cannon barrage during the war against the French, the Napoleonic Wars. And he did, you know, the 1845 expedition was his fourth expedition to the Arctic. He was a tough guy. So at age 60, you know, he had the chops to do it. And frankly, you know, you're on a ship which is well-equipped. It has heating. It has other comforts. He should have been able to survive. Why he died, we don't know, because no one has found his body.
Taking a voyage like this, what do we know from letters and journals about how much thought the crew gave to the fact that they might not return?
There are a couple of fascinating characters. One, a guy named John Reed, who was the ice master. His job is to read the ice and to give a judgment to the commander whether it looks safe to proceed or not. So he's a crucial character. And another even more fascinating guy named Captain Fitzjames, who's the captain of the HMS Erebus, which is Sir John's flagship. Sir John lived on and worked on the Erebus, but the captain of the vessel is this Captain James Fitzjames. From letters that both men wrote, which managed to get home because they were written before the expedition disappeared in the Arctic, we know from them that there was a lot of optimism that the crew, these two men said, really liked Sir John, that their mood was very positive, that people were telling them, for instance, in Greenland, that it was surprisingly mild that year. And they thought as they headed into the archipelago and into the unknown largely as they get deeper into that long chain of islands in what is now the Canadian Arctic, they thought they had a really good chance of succeeding and coming home as heroes.
Can you remind everybody of why the Northwest Passage was such a burning goal?
It started off really as a peacetime effort for the British Royal Navy. They won the war against Napoleon and his allies in 1815. And just as we would understand today, once the world's biggest navy doesn't have a war to fight, the politicians say you got to cut costs. So they start cutting officers' salaries. They start laying off sailors. Cut, cut, cut. So the top civil servant in charge of the Royal Navy, a guy named Sir John Barrow, takes it upon himself to find a mission that they can, you know, to stop the cost cutting during peacetime. And he settled on polar exploration. So in part, it was a way of giving the Royal Navy a new purpose. It was, you know, also an attempt, of course, to find a trade route from Europe to Asia. But quite frankly, even today, even though now we know exactly the routes that form the Northwest Passage today, it's really not a practical trade route. Every once in a while, a ship will go through and there'll be headlines, but it's not something that can replace year-long trade. Now, we can talk about this later if you want. As climate change proceeds, and if scientists are correct in what they're predicting, that's all going to change. The Northwest Passage could well become a constant trade route. So in the Victorian era, when we're speaking about 1845, it was more of a geopolitical, strategic, symbolic point that they wanted to make, that we are the British Royal Navy, we can go anywhere on the planet, and this was sort of the last main route that they need to prove they could find first. Now, Russia's on everyone's mind today. One of the reasons they wanted to find it first, an argument that Sir John Barrow explicitly made, was if we don't find it first, somebody else will, and the somebody else was the Russians.
And of course, who gets there first and who navigates the route first means it has something to do with who gets to control the seas there. Is that right?
Roughly. You know, again, I don't think anyone who understood the Arctic imagined that there would be constant traffic through there. It was much more of, you know, I think the best comparison in our generation was the moon mission. Mm-hmm. You know, no one perceived even an effort to put a permanent base there. It was enough to plant the flag and come home. In the next generation, it's going to be Mars. And they're great comparisons in my mind because it's a bit of a race with other powerful nations of the age. And it's also an attempt to show your technological superiority because they had to build what were technologically advanced ships and supply efforts and other things of the day. And the third point in similarity is they are literally voyaging into the unknown. When you're going into the middle of the Arctic archipelago in 1845, you are literally, at least for non-Inuit people, non-Indigenous people, you are going to a place that no other Europeans have seen before. So they must have had in their heads, you know, if we get lost, because people had been lost and trapped in the ice before, will anyone be able to find us? Which I can imagine people thinking if you're on your way to Mars. If we get in trouble, is anyone going to come and get us?
How do you retrofit a ship old enough to have participated in the War of 1812 and make it seaworthy in the Arctic?
They reinforce the hull. One of the interesting technological advances, it sounds pretty backward today, but it was, you know, cutting edge in those days. They decided we need steam power, not to break through the ice, because although the ships were reinforced, they weren't reinforced enough to really crash their way through the ice. So what they did was take working locomotive engines, train engines, took the wheels off, and lowered them into these ships. And these are enormous vessels. They're bomb ships. They were used in war. The Terror, for instance, HMS Terror, was part of the attack on Fort McHenry outside of Baltimore. So when people sang the Star-Spangled Banner, which was, in the first instance, a poem, when it speaks of bomb bursting in air, some of those bombs came from HMS Terror. Hmm. So they're sturdy vessels. They can take the weight of a locomotive inside of them. but it doesn't generate a lot of power. They're mainly to make a run if a crack opens in the ice, which is called a lead. If there's a lead and they think they can make a run through it, they would have turned on the steam engines and tried to get through faster than wind might have carried them. You know, there are other technological advances. For instance, the propeller could be drawn up so that it wouldn't get snagged on ice and that sort of thing. One of the things that archaeologists will be able to tell us now that they're looking at the wrecks is whether that might have malfunctioned. Was there anything wrong with these new devices?
Another thing that's really amazing is how much they brought with them. On any account of an ancient voyage, I'm always fascinated by the things that they took along with them. They had, we should note, a lot of food, enough provisions for a number of years for those 129 men.
Right. Now, on the way over, they had live oxen. When they reached,
wow.
pretty good, right? When they reached Greenland, they slaughtered them. So they had that stored. The officers each had their own wine collection, which is pretty nice. They had large libraries, so most of the sailors were illiterate, but the officers certainly, in their spare time in their cabins, could read literature and history and such.
You say large, like 1,000 volumes.
That's right. A wide variety of books, some of them, and books that people fixing things or plotting courses or such would want, but others purely for entertainment. They even had books with plays in them, and this was on purpose because you expect to get trapped in the winter ice. You might spend one winter unable to move. And you would expect that you might hit another one because previous expeditions had survived two or more. So you want to have entertainment. What did the men do? They would perform plays. And the case where men had to play female parts, they would make costumes, dresses and such, and whole sets. And there are actually descriptions from previous expeditions that got stuck, beautiful descriptions of men in freezing conditions. They could see their own breaths, inside the ship as they're celebrating and cheering to other crew members performing a play. So they did have comforts. They even had music. They had hand organs that would play hymns and such. They had a lot of comforts, but I've been in the Arctic in the dead of winter when the sun doesn't come up, and they were in the high Arctic, so that the period of no sun is even longer. And I can tell you, when the wind howls up there and it's dark, it's a pretty terrifying experience. So although they had comforts, I imagine it, as they started to get sick, as men started to die, it must have been terrifying.
My guest is journalist Paul Watson. He was a war correspondent for 20 years, former LA Times Asia Bureau chief, and he covered the Arctic for the Toronto Star. His new book is called Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Paul Watson about his new book, Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. Paul, you mentioned earlier that, you know, men began to get sick and to die. Exposure was certainly an issue. They were given clothes that might have been nice for a brisk London morning, but really were no match for the Arctic.
Yes. Now, one of the things you can really feel the cold when you look at scraps of boot leather that have been found. And, you know, it's excruciatingly thin when you imagine what you would wear if you went up there as a tourist. You wear big sort of moon boots. And when you look at what Inuit hunters wear, they wear, you know, animal fur. And they even take, there's an animal people would recognize called the muskox, which has those sort of...
curly horns.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And really long hair. It turns out muskox fur is by weight the warmest natural fiber in the world, and they take clumps of it, the Inuit do, and stick them in their boots, so it makes wonderful insulation. So you can, I'm told by experts, that what the British sailors would do would take a straw and stuff that in the toes of their shoes, their boots. Now, compare straw to muskox fur, you can just imagine they've got frostbite and possibly gangrene the longer they go, and it's cold.
I know that medicine was relatively crude in the mid-19th century, but they don't seem to have brought a lot of supplies along in the event that people started getting seriously ill.
Among the artifacts that have been found is a small wooden medicine chest, and there are medicines of the day in it. Not all of them had been used up, so you see that was found before the ships were found. That was found in the 19th century, and you can actually see photographs of this online the website of a museum in England. And when I look at it, as I did when researching the book, I wonder, you know, why was that bottle empty and then another bottle isn't? What was the surgeon on board treating? And one of the artifacts that has been brought up from the wreck itself, from HMS Erebus, is kind of a fascinating little taste of Victorian England. It has Samuel Oxley on one side of the bottle and London on the other. And apparently Samuel Oxley was a royal chemist who had invented a patent medicine, an over-the-counter medicine, using Jamaican ginger root, which I guess would be used to treat stomach ailments or something. So you can just imagine that these are the sorts of things that connect us to the men on those ships. You can imagine some poor sailor with a stomach ailment, and he goes to the surgeon and he gives him a teaspoonful of essence of ginger root.
So we know that they didn't make it. We can assume that they were stuck in the ice for a prolonged period of time. But it's not that the ships went down.
Right. Now, we can get into this, but the original sort of narrative, which has lasted a very long time, based in part on the fact that when searchers did start to find things, skeletal remains and other objects, they followed a path along the western shore of what is called King William Island, which is an island just north of the North American coast. So if you go far enough north, you hit the end of the North American continent, go a little bit further, and you're on King William Island. So it seemed from that evidence that the sailors, we know that there were 105 survivors because a note has been found which recorded this. 105 men abandoned ship in 1848 in the spring. And the thought was that they tried to walk south, to walk their way out of this disaster. But we now know, since both ships have now been discovered, that the ship, you can actually draw, and there's a map in the book. I would urge people to look at the map. I get a chill just thinking about it. You can actually draw a straight line from what it is called the point of abandonment, which is in sea ice off the northwest corner of King William Island, draw a pretty straight line south, and you come to Terror Bay, and that's where the Terror was found, purely by coincidence, because Terror Bay was named years after the ship was abandoned there, and no one knew that the Terror was there. It's just one of the many odd coincidences in this tale.
It was a joke, actually, after the ship was found.
Right, like, duh. but to give searchers a break, I think the Terror Bay was named in 1859. It ended up there some years before that. We don't know precisely when. So, you know, probably would be the first place you'd look just because serendipity plays a large role in this story, but apparently nobody did until just recently, last fall, and she was found there, submerged. Draw that straight line further south, almost due south, and you find HMS Erebus very close to the coast of North America. This is pure speculation. I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist, so I'm allowed to do this. But there are experts who are saying that the evidence is starting to mount, which really points to the possibility that both ships were remanned. We know that they were abandoned in the sea ice, but the currents and the ice flows and all of the hidden hazards such as shoals make it highly unlikely that the ships would have simply drifted to where they are in that roughly straight line from north to south heading toward what they thought was safety on the continent. So let's imagine that somehow the men went back to the ships. Perhaps even they may have seen them floating past, because we know this has happened before. The president's desk, for instance, the Resolute desk, is wood that comes from HMS Resolute, which was abandoned, trapped in sea ice, and eventually broke free and drifted, and then it was discovered by American whalers, brought down to the eastern coast, and then restored and returned to the British. And later, to say thanks, they made a desk out of it and gave it to the President of the United States. And to this day, it sits in the Oval Office. I digress. The fact that the Terror is due south of Erebus suggests that perhaps both ships were in Terror Bay at one point. The Terror is due north. And one of the startling things about the Terror is that the anchor, what appears to be the anchor cable, which is a thick rope, is drifting free from the ship, which suggests, again, pure speculation. Much more work needs to be done, but it suggests that that ship might have been at anchor. Now, that leads to the possibility, because Inuit of the day had a story which has been passed down through generations, that there was a tent on shore with a large number of men, perhaps as many as 30, who were dead. So you put that piece into the puzzle. Perhaps both ships were in Terror Bay. A large number of men died. You didn't have enough men to man two ships anymore. So maybe the survivors boarded the final ship and sailed herself. So you start to get a new narrative that suggests, as men were dying, they were valiantly trying to sail their way out of the Arctic, which, you know, as a storyteller, is just a fascinating possibility.
So, Paul, by 1847, 1848, the British recognized that there was probably a problem because they had heard nothing. A number of search parties were sent over the years. Franklin's wife never stopped looking for him. Why didn't anybody go and find local people and say, have you seen evidence of these men, of these two ships?
At first, there's a colonial arrogance to part of the problem. At first, the so-called experts, this includes, explorers who had been to the Arctic before, they made the argument that since Sir John Franklin's instructions from the Admiralty, which we can read today, they're very detailed, since those instructions told him to sail north through what is called Wellington Channel, that the best place to look is in Wellington Channel. Now, it helps to know here, you know, why would he sail north? A key element of the problem is that at the time, the scientific consensus was that if you sail north, you'll come to a warm, open sea at the top of the world. Now, today, anyone on the internet can look at the polar ice cap, as long as it lasts, and say that's a ridiculous notion. Why would you think that when you go north, it gets warmer, it gets colder? Well, that's what they thought, that if you just find a way through the ice, you'll have clear sailing over the top of the world, and bingo, you're home free. We know from the same Captain James Fitzjames I mentioned earlier, he wrote in his letters home that at dinner this came up, and Sir John said he didn't believe in the open polar sea. But he was an obedient servant of the Royal Navy, and we do know from the note that was left by survivors that he did in fact sail north. They must have run into ice, as you would expect, but because apparently it was a relatively mild winter in their first year, they were able to sail south again, and then they got stuck in ice. But not a big problem. They were expecting to, and they were ready for it. A few men died that first winter, but then they sailed off again, and then they got stuck twice. It's the second time they got stuck that was their major problem. The winter suddenly became extremely cold, and we know this from Inuit oral history. They couldn't hunt up there, and they tell of a terrible period of years of extreme cold. So when people go looking for them, they naturally go looking where the instructions told Sir John to go. But that was not where he was, where his survivors were. They tried to head south. And Sir John, we can expect, would have told his men, again, speculation, but Sir John's previous missions were overland, and he helped map by walking and canoeing to the northern shore of the continent. He helped map the western exit of the Northwest Passage. So we can imagine that he would have instructed his men, if you get in trouble, head south. There's a way out that way.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Paul Watson. We're talking about his new book, Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. Franklin died before things got as bad as they were going to get, but we have no idea how or why.
There's no record that says why, and his remains haven't been found. But again, Inuit oral history has a tantalizing possibility. You know, not all oral history is accurate, of course. Some of it is way off. But one persistent story that keeps coming up, which seems to, you know, elements of it seem quite strong. Again, this is coming from experts, not me. Because the Erebus was found in an area of what's called Eastern Queen Maud Gulf, where Inuit oral history said there was a ship. And in fact, a small island right next to where the ship was found in relatively shallow waters, translated from Inuktitut, means where it sank. Again, you'd think, duh, why didn't you go check the island called where it sank? Apparently nobody figured this out. So that strong Inuit oral history suggests that this might also be true. Inuit speak of boarding a ship. They couldn't figure out how to get into it because it was all locked up, which is intriguing because the Royal Navy rules are such that if you abandon ship, there's very strict steps you have to go through. You have to, you know, the final steps are to bolt it down so that it's completely closed. So we can imagine that when the Inuit found the ship, it was still in that locked up state. They couldn't figure out how to get in, so they broke a hole in the hull to get in. And when they got in, one of the things they say they found was the body of a dead man. He was large, and he had a smile. He was seated in the darkness. Now, experts...
That's a creepy story.
It is creepy. and I, you know, I apologize, but
that's a good story.
Okay, it's a ghost story. You know, ice ghosts, because the, you know, the so-called smile, experts tell me, could be a rictus smile. You know, that we won't go into gruesome details, but people understand that a body left for a period of time, the gums recede and the lips recede, and it looks to someone like a smile. So whether or not that story is true, nobody knows. But if it is true, again, pure speculation, could that be Sir John Franklin? Could his men, because he was a knight of the realm, he was a hero, you know, a very beloved figure in England. Could they have thought, we need to bring Sir John home? And if that was him, the presumably he would have been on that ship when the Inuit boarded it. But then the question is, where is he now? I should add quickly that there are Inuit who believe, for all sorts of reasons, it's in the book, that he wasn't aboard the ship, that he was actually buried up there and could still be found. There are people looking for him.
My guest this hour is journalist Paul Watson. We're talking about his new book, Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. It tells the story of what happened, or what we think happened, to the 1845 expedition that left England, went to search for the Northwest Passage. 129 crew members all disappeared, and their fate is still a question. The two ships on that expedition have been discovered. We'll resume this conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Paul Watson. He was a war reporter for 2 decades, former LA Times Asia bureau chief. He covered the Arctic for the Toronto Star. Now he has a book out called Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Paul, I have to ask you, there are lots of lost ships in the Arctic, lots of doomed missions. Why was this one something that people just couldn't forget about?
Part of it was the Franklin name. When he did his overland, one of his overland expeditions, his group almost starved to death because he stayed too long up there. They got the weather turned bad, and they ran out of food. They were living on lichen, you know, scraped off rocks. And literally he had to start eating his boot leather. So he became known in the British press as the man who ate his boots. So, you know, you add the popular press of the day, which was just, you know, really starting to take off in England. There were more and more people who were able to read, and you had this phenomenon of people who became larger than life because the newspapers, built them up. So part of it's just the legend of Sir John Franklin. The name attached to it is. But, you know, I don't want to get too mystical about it, but I started out on this story not terribly interested in it, because as a Canadian, you know, we're taught in school about Sir John Franklin and his expedition. So I knew a little bit about it, and that's pretty much all I wanted to know about it. But once I started to dig into it, it really gets into your blood. Now, you know, as you say, there's lots of lost ships in the world. there are lost ships full of gold and diamonds and other interesting things, valuable things. No such valuable things exist on these ships, so far as we know. They're just ships. So again, your point, why the fascination? I honestly think in my heart that there's something about this story. It's Shakespearean in a way. It speaks to each generation in a new way. The people involved, one of the most important characters, Lady Jane Franklin, the widow of Sir John, she helped keep this in the public eye as long as she was alive in Great Britain. And part of her incredible legacy is that we're still talking about it even today. You know, imagine if Jane Franklin had done what the Admiralty and various so-called experts told her to do, which was to just stay home and be the quiet widow and just get over it. If she had done that, perhaps we wouldn't be speaking about it today. But she made it her business to get people like Charles Dickens, the then president of the United States, Zachary Taylor, the Russian government, and others focused on this, and perhaps that gave it a life.
You were traveling with the Canadian Coast Guard when they were searching.
That's right. There was only room on the icebreaker, which was the lead vessel in the search. All of the marine archaeologists, the land-based archaeologists, the others involved in this search expedition were based on that icebreaker. There was only room for one journalist, so I lucked out and I had the lower bunk in a cabin with the head of the marine archaeology unit, which also, frankly, helped me get interested because he told me a lot of things I'd never heard before.
Hmm.
The one that eventually really grabbed me was after the discovery, I found out that it was one of those moments where history is made by someone who's least expected to make it. In the case of the discovery of the Erebus, there was a helicopter pilot named Andrew Sterling, who, while land-based archaeologists and a man working for the service that maps the Arctic for the Canadian government, were working on a small island. He was patrolling the shoreline with a shotgun, so if there were any polar bears, he could deal with it. He had a hobby interest in archaeology, so he kept his eyes peeled on the ground, and he discovered an iron piece. It's called a davit piece, which is, you know, and anyone who's into boating would know this. It's a device that's attached to a lifeboat or an external boat on a larger ship, and it lowers and raises it. He found this rusting iron piece pressed right against a rock, and if you look at photographs of it sitting against that rock, I think most of us would miss it. He found it, and the Erebus is not very far offshore in relatively shallow water. That was sort of the breakthrough clue. Now, you know, you can say, so what? He got lucky. But here's Andrew Sterling's backstory. His father was in the British Royal Navy. He himself was born in Scotland, and his grandfather was in the British Army, fought in the trenches in World War I, and was badly wounded so that his hand was somewhat mangled. He ended up being a furniture polisher at the Queen's Balmoral Castle. So if you were going to script this, if you were going to pick the one guy, you know, in the whole expedition to find that breakthrough clue that almost pointed to a submerged wreck that people had been looking for generations, you'd probably script it as a guy who had a Royal Navy history. If I can get mystical again, I think he's the likely guy to find it because the Inuit will tell you, and I obviously believe it because I called the book Ice Ghosts, that they will tell you that there are things that you can't see up there that are communicating with people in ways we don't understand. And I don't think it was an accident that Andrew Sterling found that davit piece.
I want you to talk about the ghostly, really ghostly reappearance of the Terror, which made its presence known in a way that is unforgettable.
This is another, essentially a ghost story, a spirit story, if you prefer. There was a privately funded foundation called the Arctic Research Foundation, which has its own boat, and called the Martin Bergman, which is named after a federal scientist in Canada who died in a plane crash. Quite an important figure. That he's someone who should be better known, and I hope he becomes better known, because he was very devoted to, you know, explaining climate change and the various threats that the Arctic represents, but which are not widely understood by the public. That was sort of his life's mission. On the Martin Bergman, in the late summer of 2016, is a man named Sammy Kovic, an Inuk hunter who's a guide on the vessel. And they're supposed to be on their way eventually to join up with the larger search operation, again, based on an icebreaker. But they're further north. They're closer to the area where the Erebus and Terror were abandoned in 1848. And Sammy Kovic starts speaking to a guy named Adrian Shimnowski, who runs the foundation up there, and completely out of the blue says, "You know, Adrian, a few years ago, I was with my uncle and my pal, another hunter, in Terror Bay in the winter, and we came across a mast sticking out of the ice." And he, as he told the story, he described getting off his snowmobile and literally grabbing onto it, hugging the mast, and having photos taken of himself doing this. Now, it to me seems impossible that a mast would be sticking up through the ice so many years after that ship sank.
160 years, 170.
That's right. Now, it doesn't make any sense at all. But, you know, Sammy Kovic insisted that it was true. And unfortunately, the camera with which he took the photographs fell out of his pocket. He lost it. So there's no photographic proof. Now, you hear these stories often in the Arctic, and this is sort of emblematic of the larger problem. British searchers heard stories, and they dismissed them because it made no sense to them, and they thought, well, these are savages, as they put it. That's a racist thing to say. We would never say it today. But that's what they thought. These are people who lie and make up stories. Well, Adrian Shimnowski knows the Arctic very well, and he understands the Inuit very well. He didn't dismiss the story, as odd as the story seemed. He held a meeting of the crew and said, "Shall we divert and go to Terror Bay?" They agreed, and then they approved it with the boss, and off they went. And sure enough, that's where the Terror was. It's just a, you know, you can try to explain that away, but I have no explanation for that. He had an encounter with something. Whether it was a real mast, I find very hard to believe. Whether it was an apparition, I just don't know. But it led to the discovery of a ship nobody else could find.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Paul Watson is my guest. We're talking about his book, Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. Paul, what has been recovered from now these two discovered shipwrecks?
Probably the largest object is a bronze cannon called a 6-pounder, because it fired 6-pound cannonballs. It's a beautiful object, and again, people can see photographs of it. The earthenware china has been found. A high-tech object of its day, which was designed to bring light and air into the ship. You can imagine life aboard a ship in winter when you can't go, you know, most of the men wouldn't go outside. Some would go out on scientific missions, but dead of winter, you're stuck inside this ship at close quarters with a lot of men who aren't bathing. You can imagine it's not a lot of fun. The air is not great. Someone invented a little small skylight which would allow some ventilation. One of those has been found. Buttons, things like that.
There will never be a written record as far as we can imagine, right?
Well, again, the marine archaeologists are divers and scientists, so they're very interesting characters. Divers tend to be adventurous people, I think. People would imagine them. You think of Jacques Cousteau, for instance. He was an adventurer, but not a trained archaeologist. These guys are trained, so they're adventurous, but they're also very cautious. So when you talk to them about the possibility of what they might find, they don't want to speculate too much, but they've told me that it would be perfectly reasonable to expect that if the ships were abandoned in an orderly fashion, which, according to the one document we do have, they were, that someone would have perhaps sealed logbooks in a container with wax, for instance. That would be a logical thing to do. There were metal cylinders designed for the purpose that you would put a report of your present location, weather conditions, that sort of thing, seal it and toss it overboard so that if it floated to a place where someone found it, it then had instructions in several languages to get it to the closest British consulate or somehow get it to the Admiralty so that they would have a report of the last known location. It's very possible that notes, written logbooks, other things could be on one or both of those wrecks.
It sounds like you don't think the story is over.
Not in a long shot. They also had a daguerreotype camera when they left. And people will know these as the metal plate early photographs. And these marine archaeologists who work for Parks Canada, a federal agency in Canada, have even researched this. And they've concluded from their research that if daguerreotype photographs were made, processed, and left somewhere on board those wrecks, that in the frigid waters, they're below freezing, of the Canadian Arctic, they could well have been preserved. So, we don't know. But they might actually find photographs.
All right. If we hear about that, I might want to call you back and get an update. Journalist Paul Watson worked as a war reporter for 20 years. He was Asia Bureau Chief for the LA Times, covered the Arctic for the Toronto Star. Now his book is out. It's called Ice Ghosts, The Epic Hunt for the Lost Franklin Expedition. Paul, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It was really a joy.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the podcast at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.